From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Steve Goldstein, Washington Bureau Chief for MarketWatch, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is CBS Radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Jamal Khashoggi, a prominent Saudi journalist and self-exiled critic of Saudi Arabia's regime, has been missing since entering the Saudi embassy in Turkey almost a week ago. And accusations over the circumstances of the disappearance and his current whereabouts have ignited a diplomatic crisis with global implications. Nikki Haley, the United States ambassador to the United Nations, resigned her post in a move that surprised the Trump administration and fueled speculation on the reasons for the timing of her departure and what she has planned for her political future. U.S. President Donald Trump began a series of political rallies that were part victory celebration over the placement of Brett Kavanaugh on the U.S. Supreme Court and part campaign rally as he used the bitterly divisive confirmation proceedings and opposition protests to inspire his base for the upcoming midterm elections. And the U.S. financial markets took a significant tumble this week, the longest slump since the Trump election victory in 2016. Analysts are scrambling to determine the causes of the decline and where the markets are headed from here. So, gentlemen, let's start with the disappearance of Jamal Khashoggi, an award-winning journalist for The Washington Post. His disappearance in this whole case sounds like something out of a fictional spy novel, quite frankly, but it's all too real. And the incident is adding further stress to already strained international relationships as the speculation and accusations are flying. We'll start with you, Tom. There is a lot of speculation, as I said. We don't know everything, but what do we know for sure?
Well, we know for sure that Khashoggi entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul several days ago.
And I said embassy, consulate.
Yeah, consulate in Istanbul. And there's no indication that he ever left. And Turkish officials have said publicly that they believe he was killed in the consulate and his body was dismembered so the remains could be taken out of Istanbul on one of two small aircraft that private planes that flew into Istanbul the day all this is supposed to have happened. The Turks have been doing something they usually don't do. They've been sharing their intelligence with other intelligence agencies, including the United States. And this, as you said, is going to put a real strain on relations, especially since Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, is the point man for the U.S. government in Saudi Arabia. It's going to be very interesting to see, but this is not the sort of thing you want out there when you're trying to calm things down before an election, which is now less than a month away.
Steve, again, when we talk about kidnapping, abduction, murder, dismemberment, I mean, the terms that we're throwing around here talking about a journalist are disturbing, gruesome, and foreboding in a way. We're talking about two national leaders in the Turkish President Erdogan, where there's some irony there for me in him talking about freedom for the press and press rights and that sort of thing. And Mohammed bin Salman, better known as MBS, a controversial leader, if you will. Talk about the relationship between these two, the relationship between the countries, and how this is being strained by this particular incident.
Well, I mean, the whole Turkey-Saudi relationship has been tense for some time, and, right. And really, we should broaden this out. Really, you have the big players in the Middle East. You have actually Saudi and Israel on one side. And really, you have Iran and, to a degree, Turkey, possibly Syria. It's tough to neatly draw these lines. But there have been tensions for quite some time. But the fact remains that if the assassination, and it certainly looks like an assassination to anybody with their eyes open, happened on Turkish soil, it's a tremendous own goal, if you will, for the Saudis. I mean, they certainly didn't have to kill a journalist, even one who they feel very threatened by. And that really speaks to, I think, a broader environment for journalists worldwide. And
So you think they did it because they can? That's really the motivation for doing this, because he was an outspoken critic of the regime. But for that reason and that reason alone, they've decided to essentially eliminate him, allegedly?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely what happened, because there's no really other explanation. We do know that MBS, as he's called, the new Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, has taken a very aggressive tone, even as with some of his internal opponents and what he did when he got to power. And so even as he pushes this reformist agenda economically, he still sort of plays by, let's say, maybe the old rules of the Middle East. You know, this is also putting a huge pressure on the United States. The Trump administration has made the relationship with Saudi Arabia really the cornerstone of its Middle Eastern policy. And of course, you know, all presidents from the recent past have had some degree of a good relationship with Saudi Arabia, owing to the fact that they're the swing oil producer in the world.
By necessity, yeah.
But the Trump administration has taken that even further, and really they've oriented their whole policy around it, including their opposition to Iran. They seem to have run it through a filter, a pro-Saudi filter. So this really puts both the White House in a difficult position, and also we're seeing it's putting U.S. companies in a very difficult position. There are so many with existing relationships, certainly in the world of defense spending, in oil. But also you have a lot of – there is a very important investment conference coming up, and already a number of U.S. media companies, including the New York Times, have said that they're going to be withdrawing from participating in this big conference.
And I want to get to Tom for his take on this. When we talked about the balance of things here, I think that's something that we talk about a lot when we talk about the Trump administration, sort of the balancing of this still relatively new administration who's learning on the job, balancing the policy issues. And you have big oil weapons sales to Saudi Arabia, and you have the NATO partnership with Turkey. How does the Trump administration balance these issues, these topics, and these different sort of seemingly irreconcilable differences?
With a lot of rhetoric, I think, Michael. Yeah. I don't think the policy is going to change much. President Trump has already been asked about the arms sales, $110 billion to the Saudis, and he said, well, you know, I think those are going to go forward, because if they don't buy them from us, they'll say, thank you very much, we'll go to China and we'll go to Russia, which obviously would be anathema to President Trump. And the president said that would really be bad for the American economy and would be bad for jobs, because these arms sales with the Saudis will create jobs. So I think that telegraphs how the administration will ultimately tilt on this. But I think the president's going to have to do something, if for no other reason. There's an act of Congress called the Magnitsky Act, which requires a president within 120 days of something like this to determine whether sanctions are in order. I don't think the president wants to impose sanctions on Saudi Arabia for the two reasons Steve has already talked about. And the other thing is they are seen as a linchpin of a possible Middle East peace deal, which I think seems a little elusive at the moment. So for all those reasons, I don't think the president wants to come down hard on Saudi Arabia. But if it is conclusively established that Khashoggi was in fact murdered in the Saudi consulate or in the Saudi consul general's residence about a mile away, I think the president's going to have to do something other than say, well, as he's already said, I don't like this one bit.
Yeah, I think that we'd all like to see this U.S. government, in the face of further evidence, take a strong stand against this type of action in general. And I think as all of us as journalists in the room, it is particularly chilling, this particular episode. Let's move on to Nikki Haley, who took everyone by surprise in announcing that she would leave her post at the end of the year, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, a role where she had staked out a strong and a rather independent voice as for foreign policy in the Trump administration. For those who don't know her worldwide, Steve, who is Nikki Haley, and why is this particular thing so significant in terms of U.S. politics now and in the future?
So Nikki Haley came into the administration as a Republican, she was the governor of South Carolina, and somebody who had managed to be a weighty person on the political scene, but not in the orbit of Donald Trump. In fact, she famously endorsed Marco Rubio.
She was as close to a never-Trumper as you can get without actually joining that particular card-carrying club.
Absolutely. And so she came in with a little bit of distance, which I think, proved helpful. And I think when she entered the administration, it was widely seen really on both sides of the aisle as a positive fact that she was going to be the United Nations ambassador, someone with a more traditional view of alliances around the world, although certainly from a conservative perspective. And you saw that during her tenure in the United Nations on issues including Israel taking positions that maybe some past administrations would not. But anyway, certainly on the issue of Russia in particular, she had been very vocal in opposing some of Russia's efforts around the world in a way that President Trump had not. The Trump administration has sort of run multiple foreign policies simultaneously for some time. And you do have sort of this, what he would probably label deep state or maybe a more traditional Republican view toward different countries, including skepticism toward Russia, and his own more warmly received relationship and very personal one with Vladimir Putin. So the fact that she's exiting could represent a departure or a move more toward how President Trump sees the world. But the way sometimes this White House sort of operates on different levels, she could be replaced by someone of similar views.
It's very, very difficult to tell at this point in time. Steve just talked about the fact that there are two separate foreign policies, and I think two is generous. There could be even more foreign policies if you count State Department and all the different apparatus that are working there. Is her departure more a result of her current frustrations or her future ambitions?
I think it's both. She's done a good job. She's made President Trump look good, and she is one of the few, if not the only, person who has left this administration who was able to do it sitting next to the president
of
the Oval Office.
That was quite a picture.
Two national security advisors were gone, Michael Flynn and H.R. McMaster, and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is gone. Others are gone. Scott Pruitt, the environmental administrator, is gone, and none of those got an Oval Office send-off, which tells you something about how she's very nimbly managed her resignation in a way that makes it look like she's going out on top. But I think President Trump understands she did a good job for him. She is politically ambitious. She made it clear she's not running for president or anything in 2020, but she didn't rule out 2024.
So I'm going to come back with you as we end the segment. Lindsey Graham from her home state of South Carolina really sort of set a gravelly path for himself for his reelection bid in 2020. Do you see Nikki Haley challenging him for the Senate?
I think so.
I do, too.
I think so. And she would be formidable. And the other thing is she's an Indian American. She's the daughter of immigrants. She punches a lot of tickets politically, and I think we've not heard the last of her. I think she will be in public office at a higher level than when she left as governor of South Carolina.
She is young, she is talented, she is ambitious, and I think that keeps you around Washington.
Not to mention attractive and well-spoken and well-versed in issues.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have more Issues in the News.
You're listening to Issues in the News on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download a podcast of the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Also, you can visit the program on Facebook and like us and leave a comment or two while you're there. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Steve Goldstein, Washington Bureau Chief for MarketWatch, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor.
Let's move on to what I'm calling the Trump victory tour. After securing the second Supreme Court justice of his administration, Brett Kavanaugh, President Donald Trump took to the road in a series of rallies that were part stump speech and part call to action for GOP voters in the upcoming midterm elections based on sort of the tone and tenor of what happened during this really just bitter and divisive confirmation process for Justice Kavanaugh. Let me start with you again, Tom. you've been watching some of these rallies, I'm sure, some of them. They tend to be somewhat similar now. You can sort of predict what they're going to be saying, but these are a little bit different. What is Trump's primary message at these rallies after the hearings?
I think the message is the Democrats are a mob. They're not. They will destroy our country if you let them take over control of Congress, and they're out to destroy me. So you loyal Republicans have to turn out.
With this confirmation hearing as proof that this is a concerted effort to eliminate and destabilize a duly elected president.
In the Trump construction, it's trying to save America from the forces of evil on the Democratic right. That's his message. But he's trying to make sure that his rock-solid base turns out. I mean, turnout is everything in off-year elections like 2018.
Correct.
In the years that Barack Obama was running for president and then running for re-election, the African-American vote was very strong. On the midterm elections in 2010 and 2014, African-American turnout dropped. Hispanic turnout has not been as strong in the off-year. So Trump is trying to get his true believers, his core of support, which I still think is about 35% of the country. He's trying to make sure they turn out. And, of course, the expectation is that a lot of women voters, a lot of independent voters who are appalled by, fair or not, appalled by the whole Kavanaugh process, they're going to turn out, too, people who feel like the Trump administration is anti-women. So it's a duel of turnout, a duel of how do you energize your base and who does a better job of that. And the president is leveraging all of his tools to try to make Republican turnout higher than expected.
Steve, I want to talk a little bit about the tone of these, because, again, I think the tone of these particular rallies are a little bit different. The tone on Christine Blasey Ford, who testified at Kavanaugh's hearings about her issues, her sexual assault, the Me Too movement, the mob rule tone. The president's tone has gone from sort of measured almost in the early days of these types of accusations and the subsequent investigation to almost mocking and derisive. And certainly the sort of conservative line of mob rule, you can see it in every single politician, every conservative reporter and commentator is using that same talking point. Have you ever seen a divisive message like this from a president? Certainly politics is tough, but do you think that this is unique in its level of divisiveness, or have we become overly sensitized?
So I do look, there have been other presidents who have been divisive on any number of issues, and no one with the exact tone of President Trump, though. I think that is absolutely fair to say. I can't imagine any other president saying the things he did about a woman who testified in front of Congress in a way that even Republicans said that they found credible to some degree. So the fact that he's...
How about the locker up chance now for Dianne Feinstein?
Well, that fits neatly. Well, I think there's a sexist appeal that Trump is making. And I think that played, and that was part of the 2016 election as well, that we do have a big gender divide. We're going to absolutely see it in the midterms. If you look at some of the polling, is rather incredible. I saw one poll last week of something like a 35 percentage point gap in how women and how men are approaching the midterms on so-called generic ballot. So the gender gap is real, and part of if the Republican Party is, let's say, mostly a white male party, and that's a wild oversimplification, but if it is, then of course it's natural that President Trump is going to make appeals based on that. And I think that's, if there's a logic, that is the logic to it. And there's some evidence that in terms of motivation, we've seen certainly some Republicans respond well to it. And you've seen congressional Republicans make very similar approaches, including Lindsey Graham, who we mentioned earlier.
And I want to finish up with you, Tom, because Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell called the Kavanaugh hearings and the subsequent protests by the Democrats a great political gift from the Democrats to the Republicans in advance of the midterms. Is he right?
He said, yes, he is. He said a great political gift from the Democratic mob.
Yeah.
I mean, the M word is, you see the M word a lot.
The M word. I like
they
that.
They say, yes, it was a political gift. Whatever you think about President Trump, whether you loathe him or whether you love him, and there are plenty of people who feel both ways, the last 10 days or so have probably been the most successful of his presidency. But people forget, with all the hoopla over the Kavanaugh vote at the beginning of that week, he was able to pull together a trade deal with Canada and Mexico. He said he would do it, and he did it. And so,
great jobs reports in that week as well.
Exactly right. A strong economy. And so this has been probably the most sustained positive couple of weeks for the president. The real question is, does that last? I've said it a million times. Overnight is a lifetime in politics, and we still have a little bit less than 4 weeks worth of overnights, over lifetimes, I should say, to see what happens. And so, but the president is knows what he needs to do, and he's doing it. He's playing to what might be called white male grievance. And so far, the polls suggest in some states, especially in Senate seats that are up for contest, that this has been a successful political gambit for the moment.
Well, all polling still suggests that the House will turn to the Democrats after these midterm elections, less so now for the Senate. But my question and comment is that I know that Donald Trump unarguably sets the tone for the Republicans. And I wonder, is there a Democrat who can fill that role both up to now and into the 2020 elections? And that's just rhetorical. We'll throw that out there. We're going to go quickly as we finish, to the U.S. market. So the U.S. stock exchanges took a steep fall this week, losing as much as, I believe, 10% of value in some in just a few days. Steve, this is your bailiwick. I'm going to turn to you through what are the root causes for this? And I love there's contraction, there's reduction, there's set. I love the words that are used for this. What word would you give for it, and what are the root causes for it?
I think it was a bit frothy to begin with, to be honest.
Again, great word.
And I think what happened was there wasn't any one catalyst, but there are a couple of things that are going on. And real quickly, one, the Federal Reserve has been very aggressive, somewhat aggressive maybe, in lifting interest rates. And they have at least another 3 interest rate hikes, if not 4 or 5, to come. And I think the markets are finally believing the Fed that, yeah, this interest rate hike cycle is going to continue. So that's number one. The valuations were still pretty astronomic. You have companies like even Amazon trading at incredible multiples to the earnings that they produce, even given the revenue growth at a company like that. So the valuations are very strong. You have international concerns. What's going on in Italy is kind of an overlooked issue right now, but they are starting to be in the same area that we were talking about with Greece a few years ago, and concerns about their budget, concerns about the ability for them to service their debt. So you put all of these together, and the meteoric rise in the stock market really since Trump was elected, you know, we were sort of bound for a pullback at some point. The only surprise is really the severity of it rather than the fact that it happened.
So one word answer, is it a correction or beginning of recession?
I don't think it's a beginning of a recession yet, but I think there's real concern in markets that the global economy has entered a period of slowing down.
And with that, we'll wrap it up. Thanks to Steve Goldstein, Washington Bureau Chief for MarketWatch, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to the National Journal. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. And I'm Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor. Thanks for listening.